As I mentioned earlier, you get a glimpse in Downton Abbey, a fictional account of a wealthy young American woman coming to England to catch a husband with a title in exchange for a rather large dowry to save the estate from rack and ruin. Not uncommon story of its era, as Anne de Courcy points out in The Husband Hunters. It happened a couple of hundred times. And why? Why did it happen? What was in it for the Americans? And why were the English aristocracy so in need of cash? And what have been the long-term effects of these marriages? Anne's written a number of books on social history and biography, and is an expert on husband hunting. We spoke to her a few years ago about her previous book on the husband hunters in India, but now she's moved on to the husband hunters from New York, heading to London and Europe to find titles. The Husband Hunters, Social Climbing in London and New York, published by Hachette. And Anne joins us on The Blower. Welcome back to our little wireless program, Anne.
Hello, how nice to be back.
Before we get into the economic aspects of the story, I'd like to raise another possibility with you. As a cattle breeder, I'm conscious that when you mix breeds, when you mix, say, Herefords with Aberdeen Angus, you get something called hybrid vigour. You get offspring who are, you know, which are absolutely stronger and more vital. Was that a factor on the English side, that perhaps the aristocracy needed a larger gene pool?
I think it was an accidental factor. I don't think for a minute that was why they married these lovely girls. What they wanted was, well, cash to shore up their estates. I mean, for centuries, for years and years before, they had married their sisters, their cousins, it was a very closed society, the aristocracy. And then there were a whole number of factors. Quite suddenly, there were about eight years of really appalling harvests, with the result that the yield from their land went down, the corn. So they had to drop the rents of the tenant farmers, and labourers in search of work, and because of increasing industrialisation, moved to the cities. And also the plains of America were now full of waving wheat that was coming over in large quantities in huge ships. And so the whole thing meant that in 20 years, their incomes were literally halved, down by 50%. And unless you had a coal mine under your land, which very few of them had, you pretty quickly found yourself fairly broke.
Let's look at the high end of New York society. You describe it as a vicious place. How was it regulated? Who decided who was in and who was out?
Well, the queen of New York society was Mrs. Astor. And the man who really codified it and made the rules was somebody called Ward McAllister, who acted, I suppose you'd say, as her majordomo. New York society, old New York, old money, had been people like the Astors and anybody more or less with a Dutch surname, because they were all descended from the original Dutch and British settlers, old New York society, and they entertained among themselves, and there was a kind of rigid barrier around them. They wouldn't let anybody in. Then after the Civil War, you get these huge fortunes being made, mining, real estate, ironworks, railways, enormous amounts of money. And, of course, for the wives, who suddenly found themselves rich beyond the dreams of avarice, what they wanted was society, which meant New York. But money did not talk. If Mrs. Astor was the one who decided whether you were in or out, and they didn't want the nouveau riche. But eventually, this man, Ward McAllister, he realized that sooner or later, new money, there was such a flood of it, would swamp the old guard. And so what he did was he collected about a dozen of those that everybody thought were the most honourable. Not all of them were honourable, you see. They hadn't all made their fortunes by strictly honourable means. But he collected about 12 of the ones who were most distinguished and most well thought of, plus 12 of the old guard. And they were given a certain number of tickets for what were called patriarch's balls. everybody fought to get into them. But this included, you see, a few of the new ones. And he then set up a whole series of rules, how people could get in or how they couldn't. And a lot of these women who couldn't get in would take their daughters to Europe, where they would be welcomed. If you can't, they wanted their daughters to marry well. And if you can't get your daughter into a debutante ball in New York with all the money in the world, you perhaps take her to Europe, where it is much easier.
Okay, so Ward McAllister was sort of the broker in this. And I understand,
yes.
Remind me about the 400.
Well, that was a saying. He once said that 400 people, only 400 people, could fit into Mrs. Astor's ballroom. And that was about the size of New York society then, the inner circle, the ones who were called society, the place where everybody wanted to get, climb over the stockade and enter. So even people like the Vanderbilts, who were tremendously rich, couldn't get in for a long time.
What about the Knickerbockers?
The Knickerbockers was the name for old New York society. Because, you see,
right. It was a generic term.
Yes, yes. It was because the old New York society, they were descended from the Dutch and British settlers. And the Dutch settlers had worn these, we'd call them culottes, I suppose, but Knickerbockers, calf-length trousers. And they were called Knickerbockers after that.
The Donald Trumps of the time have been admitted to the inner sanctum by Ward McAllister?
Absolutely not. I mean,
I love that that emphasis followed by a long silence.
Yes, well, they certainly wouldn't, because they didn't. As I say, money did not give you the right of entree. That's the thing. But if Trump had taken Ivanka to If Mrs. Trump had taken Ivanka to Europe and married her off to perhaps a French count or an English peer, then they would have probably.
Okay, now the Vanderbilts were the epitome of new money and seen as brash and vulgar. Tell us about Alva Vanderbilt and her magnificent party that finally cracked that establishment.
Absolutely. Well, Alva, she was born Alva Smith, and she was from a good Southern family. And Southern families used to have quite a lot of cachet because they were considered, most of them, fairly upper class. But, of course, the Civil War put a big black mark against them. And her father really lost all his money. And Alva realized, then her mother died, and Alva was only 17. She'd been educated mainly in France, which she adored. She wasn't pretty, but she was sexy, witty, attractive, and above all, very determined. And one of her friends introduced her to Willie K. Vanderbilt, because the younger ones mixed a little bit more freely than the older ones. They might have been in the same dancing class or something like that. And Willie K. was very taken with Alva. He married her. And for the first few years, she was busy having children and running the house. And then she thought, I'm going to do something about entering society. So she gave this enormous ball. She let everybody know it was coming. People were mad keen to see the inside of the new Vanderbilt house. And she, one of her excuses was that one of her friends had married the heir to a dukedom, and the ball was supposedly in honor of her. And then, at these balls, you had dances called quadrilles that young girls or sometimes couples used to perform, which you had to rehearse for ages because they were quite complicated. Well, now, Mrs. Astor was used to being asked to everything, but, of course, didn't always accept. And her daughter was very keen to go to this ball and practicing her quadrille. And suddenly Mrs. Astor realized, I haven't got an invitation. And she let this be known. She let this be known. And Alva quickly let it be known, how could I give her an invitation? It's for the senior lady to call on the junior lady first. I cannot make an overture first. And I haven't had an overture for Mrs. Astor. The next moment, Mrs. Astor's carriage with her footman in full livery went down Fifth Avenue and dropped Mrs. Astor's cards on Alva. Almost by return, an invitation came. And, of course, Mrs. Astor's daughter could not go to the ball unaccompanied by her mother to chaperone her. And so there was Mrs. Astor at Alva's ball. And Alva and her husband were in society.
I'm talking to Anne de Courcy about the husband hunters. Winston Churchill and every Conservative politician in the UK have been banging on about the special relationship, this almost transcendental link between the UK and the US. And to some extent, Churchill was being autobiographical because, forget Downton Abbey, let's talk about Jenny Jerome. Let's talk about his mum.
Yes, well, Jenny Jerome was really, I suppose you'd say, the first of the Dollar Princesses. And just as I described earlier, her mother, Mrs. Jerome, married to a very rich financier, could not get into New York society. So she decided, I am going to take my daughters to be educated in Europe. And this was during the 60s. And the court of the Empress Eugenie, which was incredibly glamorous, was perfectly happy to accept beautiful young American women who were frightfully well-dressed. I mean, as long as they were rich and could afford wonderful clothes, because Eugenie had a rule, you never wore the same dress twice, you really got a black mark then, they were welcomed. Then came the Franco-Prussian War. The court of Eugenie, of course, was disappeared. Mrs. Jerome thought, what now? Oh, goodness. England, and took her daughters to Cowes, where it was reasonably easy to meet people because there was great yachting set there and a lot of Americans came yachting at Cowes. And there she met Lord Randolph. And this was a real love story because he proposed to her after 3 days and she accepted.
And so it really was the classic case of love at first sight.
Yes, yes, absolutely. He said to... He and a friend were asked to dinner by Mrs. Jerome, and he said to the friend, I think I'm going to marry the dark one, just like that.
yet it had the deal, if you like, still had to be negotiated between the family and the Duke of Marlborough.
Well, that wasn't the Duke of Marlborough. That was Lord Randolph. The parents were the Duke and Duchess of Marlborough, and the deal was that both sides objected to this marriage. The Jeromes, because they said Jenny was so young, and the Marlboroughs, because they said, how are you going to support her? And, you know, you've got to make a living. And the deal was that Randolph went into Parliament and Jenny had a dowry. And on that basis, the two of them were allowed to marry. And he did go into Parliament and became
and
very successful.
And she was a damned skillful political operator in her own right.
Well, she knew everyone. That was the thing. And... everybody loved her, and she was very close, of course, to the king, close in all sorts of ways, I may say. And so she was...
I'm sorry, there's just been a sharp intake of breath right across Australia. You have to tell us that.
Well...
Did they get up to hanky-panky?
Yes, indeed, they did. Jenny, of course, had a whole string of lovers, and she wound up... After Lord Randolph died, she wound up marrying a man who was the same age as Winston. And she became Mrs. Cornwall. She was very beautiful, you see. She was irresistible to most men.
But she was no fool. You tell the story about how she used to read the papers every morning. She wanted to really be on the cutting edge of what was going on in politics.
Absolutely. She was very intelligent. And you see, the thing about a lot of these American girls was they were beautifully educated. They had to practice the piano for ages, and Jenny had to read all the newspapers. She could speak French, Italian. She was superbly dressed. She knocked spots. She was not a bit overawed by Blenheim and Its Majesty.
Let's go back now to New York for a minute. They didn't call it the Gilded Age for nothing. Would you share with us a story of excess and tell us about the dinner hosted by Edward Lockmeyer?
Oh, that was a tremendous dinner. It cost, I can't remember off the top of my head, but huge sums. It was, he hired Delmonico's, and the centrepiece, I remember, was a lake in which he'd got some live swans. They rather ruined the dinner, actually, because they spent the whole evening either fighting or mating, and the guests rather had to avert their eyes from the latter.
I bet some of them had sneaky looks. There's nothing like a couple of swans copulating over dinner. So swans in a golden cage in the middle of the dining area. That yes. sounds very Donald Trumpian to me.
It does rather, doesn't it? I do think there's an awful lot of parallels that can be drawn between the Gilded Age and our own, you know. I think very often there is a culture.
Are there vestiges of the Golden Age in, amongst the ultra-rich in the US now?
I would think definitely. I mean, I think there is a cult among a certain, the uber-rich. I think there is a cult of spend, you know. It's a kind of imprimatur. It shows who you are. I can do it. If you have to ask the cost of that yacht, you can't afford it. It's that sort of touch. I mean, the spending was fantastic in the Gilded Age. And the interesting thing about it was, to me anyway, was that it was one of the most, I suppose, the second most important marital duty of a woman was to spend on herself, get wonderful dresses, a marvellous house built. Women, their husbands just paid up. They could do really what they wanted. It was a matriarchal society.
Well, that's interesting, because when they get to England, it's a patriarchal society. That would have required a fair bit of gear changing.
Absolutely. I don't think a lot of them knew what hit them. I mean, there they were, brought up in the lap of luxury, treated. The key thing is daughters were treated like little princesses. You never knew who your daughter would marry. They were a weapon to rise in society. They come to England, and it's a huge culture shock. There they are, miles from family and friends, with no one around really to confide in. Nobody's treating them like a little princess. They are very much number two, if not number three. And all their lovely money has gone into the pockets of their husbands.
Well, of course, they also found that the country estate they were underwriting had appalling plumbing. Terrible heating.
Yes.
And I suppose rather disgruntled staff.
I think that was perfectly true. A lot of the staff felt that they didn't know how to, that the new chatelaine didn't know how to treat staff properly. And of course, there was very much a sort of domestic hierarchy, just like a social hierarchy then. And
well, staff can be much more snobbish than employers.
That is absolutely true. And I think they found that, you see. And they were on their own. And there they were, these poor girls. And Consuelo Vanderbilt, who married the Duke of Marlborough, he told her, I think, that there were 200 families. She had to know the order of precedence to get right. And at her first dinner party, I think there were four earls there, and you all went into dinner in order of precedence, you see. And afterwards, one of them took her aside and said, you know, I actually should have been ahead of Lord so-and-so. You must remember that.
Look, it gets a bit complicated, because you tell us that at one of these functions, husband's drunk, and he had a thing for a woman who was a male impersonator.
Just remind me which that was.
Oh, look, it's okay. It's just that he jumped off the page at me, and it was just a funny story. So here they are. Suddenly they're in this patriarchal society, and for many of them, life must have been pretty boring in the country compared to the buzz they were used to on Fifth Avenue.
Well, yes and no. Life was very boring the long winter months in the country, unless you had house parties. But the difference really was, in America, you were fated as a belle, as a young girl. Once you married and joined the ranks of the matrons, life got much duller, because fating, you just had to fight to keep your place in society. And that meant doing all the things everybody else did at the same time. It was pretty boring. Putting on your best clothes to go calling in the afternoon, going for a carriage drive in the morning, going to the opera on Monday and never arriving before the end of the first act. Whereas in England, the lot of a married woman was much more interesting. A beautiful young married woman with a bit of money could become the centre of a circle, and things like politics were discussed at dinner parties. You absolutely had your finger right at the heart of government. Because in the US then, politics happened in Washington, but society happened in New York.
In England, the women we're talking about invariably had a husband who was in the House of Lords.
You're absolutely right. And their sons were probably in the House of Commons, and quite a lot of them who went, eldest sons, would be in the House of Commons, and a common enjoyment in the common pastime in the afternoon would be to go and listen to your husband or your friend's husband making a speech in the House of Commons and perhaps congratulating him or discussing it at dinner that evening. You were much more involved.
I go back to my initial argument or suggestion that hybrid vigour was one of the consequences, and one could argue that Winston Churchill was an example. To what extent did this influx of young women, and you'd say there was at the maximum of a couple of hundred, to what extent did it transform England?
Well, you're absolutely right in saying it was a wonderful injection of fresh blood, of vigour. That is perfectly true. You've only got to look at the records of some of the children. Countess of Suffolk's heroic father, eccentric but very courageous and brave and intelligent bomb disposal expert. He turned himself into one. You've got to look at Winston Churchill. So there was that. There was also the cultural life. I mean, look at Maud Burke from San Francisco, who put English opera on the map. And a lot of them kept the roofs on stately homes that lasted for much longer. I don't think we would have Blenheim if it hadn't been for Consuelo Vanderbilt. So they had a huge influence on English, on the aristocracy and on English cultural and social life.
What happened back in New York? Was New York impoverished as a consequence of this transatlantic market?
There was a lot of huffing and puffing in the New York papers after a bit, saying why is this huge amount of dollars flowing out of our country, flowing into the pockets of what they described as effete English aristocrats? Are not our sturdy Republican sons good enough for these girls? You know, there was a sort of appeal to patriotism. And at the same time, very often, if one of the girls managed to catch the heir to a duke, they sort of crowed. And they tried to reconcile these two attitudes.
And we've got to wrap it up. You are a delight, and, of course, the author of The Husband Hunters, Social Climbing in London and New York, published by Hachette.
And that, beloved listeners, is your lot. Thanks to the team, Gail Basario, Stan Correy, Anna Whitfield, Sasha Fegan, Eddie Parnell, and Ruth Slee, Jolan Camilleri, Tim Jenkins, and up here in Musselbrook, Cecilia Connell. Oh, before I go, I mentioned this on the program a few days ago. We're doing, as you know, RN, a great amount of broadcasting on the Reformation, and we have decided to reintroduce the notion of the indulgence. And because you indulge us, we will indulge you. Your indulgences are in the mail. Thanks for your company, LNL on RN.